Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And that's what this show is all about. Hi there, I am Carol the Coach, and I am your sexual addiction specialist. Today and every Monday night at 9:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we talk about, from the experts, things that have to do with sexual addiction. You know, this is an area that is not always discussed, and this is a show that helps to bring to light the problem and the solutions, and that is so important. I mean, if you walk around with the secret and the shame and the guilt, you're more than likely not going to get help. So I am here to help you figure out what it takes to stay clean and sober. You know, I had an interesting conversation with my group tonight. We were talking about how much you divulge to people on the street, to people in your family, and to people at work if you believe you have a sexual addiction. And, of course, the group, really working on rigorous honesty, suggested that maybe in certain situations it's important to be honest with coworkers. Well, I had to say that I felt a little bit differently. I do believe in honesty. I think that when you are honest about who you are, you're much more likely to keep your sobriety, and you're much more likely to stay in recovery. But what I told my group, specifically, it was a man who was going to do some volunteer work for an agency that housed drug and alcohol addicts that were in recovery. And the question on the questionnaire or the application was, do you have a drug addiction, an alcohol addiction, or another addiction? And he was wondering whether he should put, yes, I have a sex addiction, and I am working on recovery. Now, unfortunately, he just had a few days of sobriety. And so they asked, if you have these issues, how long have you been clean and sober? Well, I felt like here's a man who is wanting to do the right thing. He's wanting to do 12-step work, which in the 12-step program, the 12th step is about giving back, and he wanted to give back to this agency. But I said, you know, in a field of experts and in a field where there are therapists, there are doctors, there are psychologists who all work with this kind of problem, we are having a hard time convincing the medical profession to include sexual addiction or hypersexuality in the statistical manual. In other words, even though I call this sexual addiction, and that's what we'll be talking to our guest, Rob Weiss, about, and Rob is director of sexual and intimacy disorder programs at the ranch and at SRI. And actually, I am so pleased to be telling you, he's actually the founding director of the Sexual Recovery Institute. So this man has a lot of experience. I have learned a lot from him, and I'm thrilled to be having him on the show later on tonight. But what we know to be true is we can't even convince our colleagues that this is an addiction. I mean, we were all ready to call it hypersexuality, and we couldn't convince them that hypersexuality was in and of itself a mental disorder or a condition that definitely interfered with functioning. So I just did not feel that this man, who's trying to get some volunteer work, should put down that he has a sexual addiction. I don't think there's enough information about it. I think a lot of people believe that sex addicts are pedophiles, and that certainly isn't the case. You can have a sexual addiction and be a pedophile, but they are not synonymous. And so I encouraged him not to divulge too much. And then we talked about boundaries. And I said, you know, this guy is so smart. He said, well, what I know to be true is that if somebody's working on their drug or alcohol recovery, their sexual addiction may go up. So I just might be putting their lives to help them understand. And I said, you know, if you feel it's appropriate and someone has shared that with you, that's fine to talk to them about that with the permission from the staff. But you don't volunteer information that people don't understand because it can further complicate your life, as well as people may have the wrong idea, since I'm telling you the medical field doesn't even get it right yet. You know, I've said I'm a pioneer. Anybody who is certified in this addiction, we are pioneers. And I got to tell you, even though sex addiction has been around forever, you're a pioneer, because we've never seen the accessibility, affordability, and anonymity that we're seeing right now with the Internet. And so if you are somebody who's listening to this show and you are concerned about your own addiction, you're at the right place tonight, because we're going to be talking about what is sexual addiction, and is it a real diagnosis, and how do you know if you're a sex addict, and how do you know if you're, or, you know, if you're listening to the show and you believe your spouse is a sex addict, what are the signs that your spouse may have a problem? And we'll just be going over some of the highlights to help navigate you through this and to get you to the right places. You know, a certified sexual addiction therapist is fabulous, but so are 12 steps, and so is a sponsor, and so is doing your reading, and a whole host, a whole variety of behaviors that will assist you in recovery. So if you're listening to this show tonight, know that you're going to learn a lot more about yourself, and hopefully we're going to destigmatize some of this stuff for you. It was interesting because I am always talking to my clients about boundaries, about relapse, about personal craziness indexes. And that is when you have a personal craziness index, you more than likely have behaviors that are unhealthy, that contribute to the chaos that contributes to sexual addiction. They may not be behaviors that directly get you to use, whether that's prostitution or internet porn or different fetishes, exhibitionism, voyeurism, but they're behaviors that make your life feel out of control. We all have them. So I want you to think about your life for a minute. And I want you to take quick inventory of what your car looks like, what your bedroom looks like, what the house may look like, or your apartment, What does your desk look like at work? And I want to ask you, are things in order so that when you walk into the room or you jump in your car, you can breathe a sigh of relief and go, ah, I'm in a good, clean environment? If it's not clean, if your room's a mess, if you haven't done your taxes in 3 years, if you don't have the proper nutrition in your refrigerator, and so you're eating Cheerios without milk and you're eating a candy bar that you found in at the bottom of your closet, you know, you've got some craziness going on, and all those things contribute to a life feeling out of control. Now, if you have those issues, you feel free to give me a call. The guest call-in number is 646-595-3284. All I ask from my callers is that they be respectful, that they talk about their real-life situations, and that they seek the help that they so badly want. You know, oftentimes you can hear a show like this. Maybe you've gone to iTunes and you've put in sex, and all of a sudden my show comes up because it's on sexual addiction. Well, you know, what we know to be true is that it's pretty doggone hard to talk about sex addiction, in part because sex is a taboo subject. We see it, we watch it, we hear about it in songs, on TV, but people are not encouraged to talk about it directly. So this is a show where we talk about it directly. Again, put this number in your cell phone so that you've got it handy as you listen to the show. And that number again is 646-595-3284. Now, another thing that creates that chaos and oftentimes boundary violations and everything is the inability to communicate directly. So I'm going to ask you, as you look at your life and you navigate through life, do you see yourself as somebody who's fairly passive? You just kind of let things happen to you. You don't make waves. You just go with the flow. And maybe that's what's gotten you in the trouble with sexual addiction, is because you just kind of went with the flow and did your own thing and have stayed somewhat isolated because you are so passive. Or maybe you're the exact opposite. Maybe you're very aggressive. And what I mean by aggressive is that perhaps you're an angry person who's consistently telling people off. You're distancing yourself from people by being abusive, abrupt, brazen, and you attack when things aren't going well. That's aggressive. It doesn't have to be physical. It can be verbal. Or are you passive-aggressive? That means you get people back behind their backs. Now, I had a client who was taken advantage of by her husband. He consistently told her she was a slob and she didn't know how to clean the house, and she was so disgruntled with him. And what she did to get him back is she cleaned the toilets with his toothbrush. Yep, you heard that right. She got him back behind his back for being so critical of her house cleaning by using his toothbrush to clean the toilets. I had a man that I worked with who was an IT person, and I'll tell you what, he really was mad at his work, and so he'd go in late, and he'd leave early, and he'd disappear, and he'd read the paper, and he just didn't spend much time working, and he had been demoted. And when he got demoted, his whole attitude changed. He didn't want to do good work anymore. He was so angry that he thought, oh, what the heck, I'll just get them back behind their backs. by just doing a terrible job and not giving them anything in return. So that's what passive aggressive is. And what I teach is, how do you become assertive? Now, assertiveness is when you are clear and direct about what you feel, what you need, and what you think. It doesn't mean you get your way on something, but you know that if your wife or husband has been berating you about something and you share with them how you feel, that you can feel confident that you are clear and direct. And that is so important when it comes to good communication and a good sense of confidence and being the person that you know is very clear and has expectations and can communicate directly. So I'm going to ask you, do you think you're passive? Are you aggressive? Are you passive aggressive, or are you assertive? Do you do a pretty good job of letting people know how you feel? Now, nobody learned that in school. And so those are some of the skills that we teach when we're working with sex addicts who need to communicate better with their wives or their husbands, at their jobs, with their kids, you know. And if you don't know how to do it, I always say, there are different formulas, and you can go to my website and get on my blog and key in assertiveness, and it will have a whole formula by which you can set things up to be very clear and direct. But remember, that's no guarantee that you get what you want. As a matter of fact, what really ends up happening is that you build more confidence in yourself because you know that you've done a great job of conveying what you needed and wanted in your life. Now, feel free to give us a call at 646-595-3284 asking any questions you want. This is your show. I'm your own psychotherapist, and I'm ever so pleased to help you with your issues. Again, that number is 646-595-3284. Now, when somebody's got some sobriety or recovery under their belt, it is really critical that they do a nice job of having and maintaining healthy boundaries. And what that means by healthy boundaries is that they know what they need to maintain a good sense of their self. That way they don't get used and abused. They do a nice, nice job of letting people know what they're willing to do. And, you know, boundaries can be tough. I mean, we need boundaries when it comes to work and your family and your kids. You know, I oftentimes get adults that, although they may have a sexual addiction, what they really also want is just some help in learning how to manage their family. And I really spend time with them talking about what is it that they need to set in terms of their own standards. Like, let's imagine that you want to go to bed with your husband or wife. You know, you want to go to bed together. And let's just say that he wants to read the paper, I'll watch TV, and have all the lights on. Well, one of your boundaries may be, no, you know, when we go to sleep, I need things to be quiet so that I can rest and relax. That's a boundary. Or, you know, let's just say that a child is disrespectful to her parent. And she's basically said, no, I won't do that. Well, the boundary from a parent to a child is to say, you know, I won't let you speak to me like that. Well, I know you may be thinking, well, how can I control that? Well, you have to be clear and direct about what you expect, and if that child won't cooperate, then you walk out of the room. You create your own boundary. And that can be very, very helpful and healthy in terms of letting that child know what you'll stand for and what you won't. And so boundaries are important. And we had a boundary the other day in the group. The group was going to go out after work, after the group session, and everybody said, hey, are you comfortable going to this eatery? That's really fun and has great food and a little loud, but it's fun. And one of the men said, I'm not comfortable going in there because there are 20-something women in short shorts. And it's a boundary for me that I not go in there because more than likely it will elicit some urges and cravings. Well, the group, of course, wanted to support him. And I knew that the other reason that he did not want to go in to that kind of establishment was because he had a boundary with his wife that he wouldn't do that. So the man did not say, hey, I can't do that because it would really make my wife mad. But he said, you know, I don't want to do that because it would compromise my recovery. That was a healthy boundary. Now, as you're thinking about boundaries, you may use the three circle method, and that method is a wonderful way of addressing three types of behaviors that will hopefully keep you aware of what are healthy behaviors and what are not healthy behaviors. The first behavior is that, well, the first circle, the outside circle, are your healthy behaviors. You know, they're all the things that you should be doing to feel good about yourself. You know, maybe that's exercise. Maybe that's plenty of sleep. Maybe that's taking your vitamins. Maybe that's going for walks with your wife or your husband. Maybe that's only watching a couple hours of TV. Maybe that's doing your spiritual reading, your meditation, your recovery work. All those behaviors fit in the outside circle. They're all behaviors that contribute towards good mental health and very active recovery. Now, the next circle, if you were to draw another circle inside of that circle, that would be called the inner circle. And there's a middle circle. Now, what's so important is that in that middle circle, those are slippery slope behaviors. Those are behaviors that could very well get you into trouble. Obviously, the man that said, I can't go to that establishment with women who are wearing short shorts, he knew that that would likely get him craving younger women. And that was his arousal template of choice, was that he liked young women. So by establishing that boundary, he did a nice job of not engaging in middle circle behavior. You know, looking at magazines with scantily clad women might be a middle circle behavior. Using your cell phone and sending texts that are inappropriate might be a middle circle behavior. you know, it's one of those things where you believe that you're not going to act out, but what you know to be true is that if you just decide to surf the net, and maybe you're looking for boating equipment, and then from there, you look at the home and garden show, and then from there, you happen to look at women in bathing suits, and then from there, you find that you are engaging in activities, you're masturbating, you're fantasizing, and you are in that zone of numbing out your feelings with sexual behaviors. And clearly, there is no doubt about it that then you're in active use. And that is the inner circle. You know, those are your sexually addictive behaviors. And so we really, really say if you follow this three circle approach, it'll help to make it very apparent that you need desperately to have some guidelines that help you when you get lax or when you're really working in early recovery. Because there are a lot of challenges to recovery, you know, and it starts with knowing what is healthy and what is not healthy. And, of course, you can't just do what's not unhealthy. I mean, you got to do the healthy stuff, too. And so with your sponsor and your therapist and your committee, your 12-step friends, you can talk about, you know, what's on their list. You know, now I got to tell you, so many of the men that I work with and women, they want to know how they can restore trust with their significant others. If you've had a problem restoring trust, give me a call at 646-595-3284. Restoring trust is critical, and it takes a lot of work. Oftentimes, addicts will ask, you know, how do I restore trust? Well, Patrick Carnes in Facing the Shadows says, if you're just sitting around telling your partner how much you love him or her, that isn't going to cut it. In part because you've already done the I love yous, and it's resulted in lots of problems. You know, that's when they found out that you were doing internet porn, or you were in chat rooms, or, you know, you went to adult bookstores. So there are some guidelines that you can do that really make a difference in restoring trust. And interestingly enough, as you might imagine, they start with you. You know, first of all, Dr. Carnes says, you know, you have to give it a lot of time. Most people who ask about how to restore trust are concerned with their marriage or their primary relationship. And trust has to be earned. And oftentimes it starts with the pain of disclosure. When partners realize that they're hearing the truth, credibility begins to return. But I'll tell you what, disclosure is such a painful process. It needs to be done very carefully. There needs to be a lot of support, both for the addict and for the partner, to create that disclosure. And I think we'll do a whole show on disclosure because, you know, I never advocate to an addict, oh, just go ahead and tell him everything you've done. Because truly, there has to be a lot of preparation. It just doesn't happen by itself. You know, it's very damaging, as a matter of fact. I mean, we talk about rigorous honesty, but if you are not set up in such a way that that person has support and has somebody that he or she can go to, maybe a 12-step group afterwards, maybe a sponsor. It can be feel so devastating and damaging that it actually destroys any trust that one could have had. Now, we did say give it a lot of time. Most recovering people say, boy, that's the most difficult part because, you know, everybody wants to heal quickly and they want to make things right. But it is so important to have patience and go slow and do it one day at a time. And, you know, in the 12-step process, they oftentimes say, don't do anything drastic for the first year. Don't get in a relationship. Don't get out of a relationship. Don't change jobs. Don't move. Don't do anything really drastic for the first year because you're going to be giving your recovery a lot of time. And then the next important factor is be willing to lose it in order to get it. In other words, you have to be willing not to give up on yourself or on the other person. And I've got to tell you, your partner has to be able to do that too. So there has to be this commitment that as you're beginning to build trust and as you go through that disclosure process, both of you have to be willing to take the risk in part, kind of lose all the trust to begin to rebuild it again. Now, the third step in this process is that you have to restore yourself first. If you do the repair work that you actually need, your perceptions of the relationship will change dramatically. You know, if there's one thing that I can emphasize is that you will develop empathy. And there's one thing we know about addicts, and that they can be very selfish, self-absorbed, it's all about me kind of people. And so when you're beginning to really work on yourself, you have this awakening that, oh my gosh, I have devastated my partner, my family, myself. And so you have to be able to get healthy, you know, and you have to develop empathy and almost put that other person up there too. You know, I can't emphasize enough that as my clients get healthy, their partner becomes the next most important person to them in that they want to spend the majority of their time rebuilding that relationship and understanding how they feel. You know, you have to also accept the illness. And boy, that can be tough. You start by acknowledging at the deepest level of yourself that you both are powerless and fully involved in the illness. You know, we used to call partners of sex addicts co-sex addicts. And we decided to stop that because it really did pathologize the partner. And we really didn't want to do that. What we know to be true is that partners have their own illness too. Sometimes it's codependency. Sometimes it's denial. Sometimes it has to do with not taking good care of themselves. So they can't imagine what it's like for the other person to get healthy because they're not healthy themselves. And you're really lucky if you have a partner who's willing to go to a 12-step group so that he or she can get healthy. Now, it's so important to have that support group available. Because as you're accepting the illness in each other, you're also looking for ways to understand what is this illness all about. And because there's enough guilt and shame around it, it's very, very difficult for people to talk about it. It really helps if you share spirituality. Explore ways to be spiritual together. You have to find the meaning in your suffering, and doing so together can dramatically shift your perspective as a couple. And, you know, I've talked about that great book, One in the Spirit, Meditation Course for Recovering Couples. It's a way to work together on yourself as a couple. And what that book encourages you to do is to dialogue with each other and to do a lot of self-reflection and talk about that self-reflection. Because, you know, in this field, there are a lot of things that need to take place. Step 8 and 9 of the 12 steps teach us to make amends by expressing regret for what we have done and doing something to make up for it. You know, I've always taught in my marital sessions, even before I ever had any real expertise with sex addicts, that couples should be allowed to do do-overs. And do-overs does not say, hey, what I did was wrong, and I want to make it up to you. Because once you've done something wrong, you can't really make it up to that person. But you can say, you know what, I realize I've really, really hurt you, and is there some way that I can do something for you that will make your life more comfortable, that will make you feel better? And when you use this approach as a model for daily living, it often allows you to take responsibility for the pain that you've inflicted on the other. You do what you can to get honest, and then you do what you can to make up for it. And that's why, you know, again, doing the 12 steps is so important, because it is a whole formula by which you can get healthy and restore your relationship. And you got to keep your expectations honest. Remember, it's never going to be perfect. Just as the ultimate partner does not exist, neither does the ultimate relationship. And when you accept the human limitations of your partner and in yourself, you're better able to be generous with your love. And, you know, that's what I have found over and over again. No matter how hurt the partner is, they typically have not lost their love for the other person. They may not believe that they can stay married. They know that they don't have the trust anymore, but the love is still there. Now, we really encourage you to work on yourself, go to 12-step meetings together as a couple, and, it, you know, if this isn't you, if you don't have a partner, get yourself to those 12-step meetings and make friends. Develop relationships with people in that group, because what we know is whatever happens in the group happens outside of the group. And so if you don't have a relationship and you'd like one, the best way to form those relationships is to get healthy with the people in the group. Because when you practice honesty and you build trust and intimacy, you can then do that outside. And then for couples, what we say is there are fellowships for couples called Recovering Couples Anonymous, RCA. And there are plenty of retreats and workshops worldwide that support couples and help them through this process. Because so oftentimes this is such dark, tough work that it's hard to have fun again. And that is so important. You know, I had this couple, and they really loved travel, and they loved to listen to music. And this woman put together a scrapbook of her husband and her trip to the Caribbean. And it was over 100 pages long, big. I mean, that's a lot of pages and a lot of fun activities that they went on and some beautiful scenery. And this was definitely one thing she wanted to do, to begin to develop new memories and new dreams together. And let's face it, although traveling can be stressful, most oftentimes it's an opportunity to create new moments together. So have fun together. You know, think about the last time you played with your kids, with your partner, with your buddies or your girlfriends. I'm promising you that closeness comes from shared experiences, and play in its own way is an act of trust. So that's one of the ways that you restore trust. And restoring trust is so very, very important. Now, there are people in this in the United States that actually have something called disclosure programs. Milton Magnus out of Texas has a program. It's kind of pricey. But if you really want a very structured way to share your feelings and you want your spouse 100% supported and you want him or her to be able to go to a group as soon as you've disclosed and you've done the polygraph test so that you can prove that you have said everything, there's nothing more that's sitting inside of you, so that they no longer have to worry that, you know, there's going to be a hidden secret that'll come out in a week or a month or a year. These kind of programs are just fabulous for making couples feel better about the rebuilding process. And so you can look for his program. I do believe it's called Hope, Strength, and Freedom, the disclosure process. And you can Google his name, Milton, M-I-L-T-O-N, Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S-S. He has a banner on my website, which is www.sexhelpwithcarolthecoach. And he's just a great guy who has created this incredible program and is now teaching people all over the country how to do this work. Now, when you're working to rebuild relationships, it is so important, that you find guides. You have to be able to have people who share their experiences and watch how they have healed in their own lives. You know, that is the beauty of the 12-step program, is that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's already been invented for you, and you get to watch people in all sorts of stages in this development. And it is important to separate religion from spirituality. You know, many people, many couples come with baggage about religious institutions that have either damaged or constricted their growth. Has that happened to you? Have you been betrayed through religion? I mean, when you're vulnerable, that really can happen, and that can have a detrimental effect on you. It's a weird situation because I got to tell you, it's the churches that are doing a lot of referring. You know, people are going to the churches and saying, I have a real problem and I want to make my life better. And that is fabulous that the churches then promote either the 12-step groups and allow 12-step meetings in their own churches, or, you know, they get their patrons to the right counselors, but they also have been known to do some damage. You know, what did I hear just the other day? Oh, I had a client who had trouble having an erection and an orgasm with his wife. And he went to talk to his minister, and he knew that he was still really suffering from sexual addiction. He was in recovery, but it was still fairly new. And this minister, and I'm sure counselors have done the same thing, said to him, well, just fantasize about somebody else. You know, do what you need to do to enjoy the moment. Don't tell her. Just do it. Well, that is absolutely the worst thing you can tell an addict. You know, that addict probably shouldn't be having sex at that point. If his brain still needs to calm down enough where he, you know, my guess is he couldn't stay focused, let alone did not have the trust rebuilt with his wife. And, you know, there are plenty of sponsors and groups that really believe one needs to abstain from sex for a while until you can really work on yourself. And I know that that sounds so dramatic. I remember when I first started with this work, I thought nobody's going to do that. But in essence, when you stop having sex, it can be a relief not to have to think about it or to look for that kind of intimacy. And certainly, if your life is nothing but images of pornography, it's almost impossible to have sex without going back to those clips in your mind. And so for that very reason, I encourage you to get a good sponsor and decide what works in your best interest. Would abstaining from sex for the next week, month, 3 months, or even a year be the thing that could calm things down and allow you to really focus in on yourself? Now, we always say that as you're in recovery, you need to do, you need to create a space, a sacred space, so that you can promote reflection and meditation. You know, every morning I get up and I spend 45 minutes reading an inspirational book. And there is no doubt that spirituality is about what is meaningful to you and what gives your life value. So what strategies do you have to help you to reflect on yourself? You know, do you do inspirational writing? Do you have a meditation book that at least once a day helps you to work on a specific 12-step philosophy? Do you do yoga? Do you exercise? What do you do to promote self-reflection? And I'm telling you, all inner journeys start with an emptying of self. And so we do a lot of talk amongst the clients that I work with on what is the surrender process. How do you do it? Because it's a work in progress. It's not like you learn how to do it and you can surrender to everybody. With surrendering, you recognize that admission of powerlessness, and then you live your life according to the principles of letting go. You know, you really do use that serenity prayer. I'm looking at it right now. It's 4 feet. It's a 4-foot poster in my office that says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that is so important. You know, that running prayer is much, much longer than that, but that's a take-home message. When you let go and you let God or your higher power take charge of your life, you will reduce your own sense of anxiety, and you'll learn that accepting what you do is enough. And that's so important. That it helps you then to heal that sexual and spiritual split that occurs. You know, when you're a sex addict, there's been a lot of damage that's been done on your psyche and your soul. And to heal, you need to acknowledge that your sexuality is about meaning and that spirituality is also about connecting to that sexuality. And you need to look for areas of commonness between the two. Now, spirituality means lots of different things to lots of people, but it really, for me, spirituality is that connection that there is something greater than myself that's helping to navigate my life. And when people say, well, what's your passion? I always say, you know, my passion is a connection that I'm making a difference in the life of others. That's what I love to do most. And that's a spiritual experience. Now, you know, I just had a couple call me today. I had recommended a therapist to do some marital work. And she said, oh, I just got on the internet and looked that therapist up, and he seems awfully religious. And we're not like that. She's actually a scientist. And she goes, we're not like that. Are you sure he's going to be the right one for me? And I am never sure. But I know he knows his stuff, and he's good with sex addicts, and he's wonderful as a counselor. And, you know, all I can say to people when they're trying new counselors is give it, you know, 6 or 8 sessions. See if it's a fit. You know, I know that maybe the first couple won't feel like they fit, but really, by week 6, you should know whether that counselor is right for you, whether he or she has helped you through some of the restoration of trust and the pain that you know, just is overwhelming. So, I would highly recommend 2 books for you on how to stay connected with yourself. Don't Call It Love and The Gentle Path Through the 12 Steps, both written by Dr. Patrick Carnes. They are wonderful, 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 wonderful in terms of breaking down what you need to do in very readable, understandable chapters. So even if you don't like to read, you can read 3 or 4 pages at a time and get a lot out of it. And you know, that's what I ask my clients to do. I say, you know, read 2 pages a day. That's all I'm asking. Just read 2 pages a day. And what I know to be true is sometimes they read more, but they hardly ever read less, because almost anybody can fit 2 pages a day in. So I am highly recommending that if you believe you have a sexual addiction, that you get on my website, www.sexhelpcarolthecoach.com, or you go to www.sexhelp.com and read the information, take the test, and let that help to be your guide as to whether you have an issue or a problem that needs some sort of resolution. Well, as you can tell, our buddy Rob did not make the call tonight, and that's okay. We will book him for a later date. And I just really appreciate you all hanging in there with me and learning a little bit more about sexual addiction. And next week, we're going to be talking with Alan Katz, who's going to be talking about workaholism. And you know, so many sex addicts actually are workaholics. And Alan has written a book called Addictive Entrepreneurship, How to Achieve Success with the Character Traits You Already Have. And it's a little bit of a diversity from what we normally talk about, but I got to tell you, he's a fabulous writer. And workaholism is my thing. I love my work so much that I'm with you right now at 10 p.m. after starting at 8 this morning and ending at 7 and having a couple hours off in between and coming back on. Now, I do schedule it for Monday so that I get my toughest day out of the way, my longest day. But when you love something, it's really important to have boundaries so that you pace yourself. And so I was really interested in this topic and can't wait to hear what he has to say. I remember what Patrick Carnes told me way back when I was training with him and I was telling him how much I loved my work and, you know, assuring him that I had my girlfriend time, my husband time, my exercise time, my reading time. And he said, Carol, you know what? You're a workaholic. And I think you probably could go to a 12-step group on that because for most of you probably know there is Workaholics Anonymous. And I'll be doggone if I came home or read the book, thought to myself, okay, that sounds cool. I would love to do that. I'd love to go to a meeting that helped me to pace myself. And there was no group to be had in Indianapolis. And my husband said, oh, my goodness, Carol, you're going to have to start the group, aren't you? So I'm looking forward to Alan Katz talking about this and wonder how it can apply to you. So we'll see you next week for another riveting show. And as I said, there will only be one of you at all times. So I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself and know that there's help out there for you. And then I want to be part of the solution. You're listening to Carol the Coach. This is Hope, Strength, and Recovery. And we'll see you next week.